Hello, I'm Jamie Graham, Editor-at-Large of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. Today, I'm joined by online entertainment writer Emily Garbutt.
Hello.
Hi, Emily. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Excellent. Yes, very good. Thank you for joining us today. We have lots of great movies to discuss, so it should be a fun time. So this week, we're rating the third and final part of the Equalizer trilogy, called, cunningly enough, The Equalizer 3. We'll also be reviewing the new romantic drama by Ira Sachs, Passages, and Bobby Wine, the People's President, a documentary following the eponymous Ugandan opposition leader. But before we start all that, Emily, and get deep into this week's releases, tell me, what have you been watching this week?
Well, I have completely devoured the third season of Starstruck, the romantic comedy series on BBC and I think HBO Max in the US.
Right.
I tried to pace myself, but I failed to do that in and out in 48 hours. Really enjoyed that.
How many episodes is that? How many hours?
It's not even that long. It's six episodes. So
right.
I think I've showed a lot of restraint by splitting that over 2 days.
I do. That's very good.
Yeah.
So how does it compare to the first two seasons?
It's quite different. It's less about, I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say that it's not as much about the main relationship anymore and more about what happens when that kind of breaks down and
right.
sort of the aftermath of that.
I'm the same as you. I'm a binge watcher. When we have programs that are on one a week, I can't do it. So I literally don't start it until like they're all up or the kind of penultimate one is up, so I can do a straight run through, because I have to do it in a day or two and have that momentum. I mean, is that kind of how you feel, or do you like a weekly episode occasionally?
I think it really depends on the show. I think some things are quite suited to the weekly drop. I quite enjoy that and the discussion and sort of like theorizing about what's going to happen. As long as I can avoid spoilers, then that's the main thing.
That's the big thing, isn't it? Like even Succession, I didn't watch the final season until it was all up. And it's so hard. I mean, it's just impossible to avoid spoilers.
That's very brave. I did not have that in me. I watched the final episode when it aired in the US. I was up all night watching that.
Very wise. Well, as for me, I've spent the last sort of 3 or 4 weeks just watching horror movies, because it's been Fright Fest has just gone at the weekend, the bank holiday August weekend. So it's 72 films they screened over 5 days. And I do the Fright Fest Awards for Total Film every year, so I try and watch all of them. So literally, I just got sent a deluge of kind of links, screening links, and I've been watching 2 or 3, 4, even 5 horror films a day for the last 3 or 4 weeks. So that was fun. I'm actually quite pleased. I mean, I loved it, but I'm quite pleased to be out the other end of it now and be able to put on a few happy things occasionally.
Any highlights?
Well, my favourite, which I gave best film to, was called Where the Devil Roams, which is a new film by the Addams Family, who did Hellbender. I don't know if you saw that a couple of years ago.
No.
They're a kind of very low budget, very imaginative filmmaking. They're actually a family. It's amazing. It's a father, mother, and their teenage daughter, and their other teenage daughter is not quite as involved, but she does sort of help out a bit. And they do everything. They write, direct, they star, they edit, they shoot, they do the music, they do everything, and they're absolutely unbelievable. I mean, really imaginative, idiosyncratic filmmakers who I kind of think, well, I know for a fact Hollywood's been sniffing around them, and so far they haven't bitten, because they want to do their own stuff. But they are, you know, very, very talented. So I recommend people see Hellbender, which is on Shudder. And then this one will be coming out, I imagine. I don't know, but I imagine it will get a release for Halloween. Let's hope so. But it's really good. Really good. So anyway, let's crack on, because we've got a lot to get through today. So we're going to start off. It's time to join Robert McCall out in Italy as he takes on the Mafia.
What happens here happens in many towns.
The Mafia. They're like cancer. No cure.
Who said you could come here?
You should stay out of other people's business.
Whatever it is you and your friends do, do it somewhere else.
You warning me?
I'm preparing.
Is that a Timex?
No.
It's a bullet.
That's the median nerve that I'm compressing.
That's a level 3.
If it goes to level 4, you will shit on yourself.
Right, Emily, set this up for us. I mean, we've all seen Equalizer 1 and 2. We know Robert McCall and what he's capable of, his particular set of skills. But where do we find him now? I mean, we know it's Italy. I've just said that. But why is he there and why is he embroiled with the mafia?
We don't really know this as the film starts out anyway. We just know that he's in this kind of mafia HQ and, you know, it's all standard stuff. Some guy's got a meat cleaver in his face, you know, everyone's in a pretty bad way. And yeah, Robert McCall is there. He wants some money. They've got some money that belongs to a friend of his. And that's kind of all we know. And he gets injured. And then he gets found by a kindly police officer who doesn't sort of question why he is very injured and also driving a car. And a doctor takes him in and he's kind of recuperating in this Italian village. But wow. it's not, you know, a nice relaxing holiday for him because it's the Equalizer. But
Of course. Yeah. In the first two movies, we saw him take on the Russians in the first film. And in the second one, he kind of came up against his old partner and all of his old team. So they're all highly trained assassins and he had to take them all out. So this one, I mean, the Italian mafia, it doesn't really get much bigger than that. So is this kind of his biggest challenge yet?
I'd say so, yeah. There's also kind of the mental toll that it's obviously all taking on the character. I think that's quite evident that, you know, the character arc throughout the trilogy, this seems like a culmination of it all for him. You know, I think he's sort of torn between this more, you know, putting it all behind him and settling down in this town and still doing what he kind of feels like he's born to do and taking on the injustices.
We know a few personal things about him, just a few. Before this movie starts, like we picked up on the fact that he faked his death in a car bomb, I believe it was. We know that he's lost his wife, Vivian. That's referred to in the first two movies. So he's obviously sort of mourning in a place of grief still many years later. But I've read interviews with Antoine Fuqua, the director, where he said that this third one is kind of all about digging deeper into the character and getting to know the kind of personal side of the story a little bit more. Does that hold true?
Don't know. I kind of felt like this film sort of holds everyone at arm's length a little bit.
Right.
Because you know, obviously Denzel Washington, you know, he's a very compelling actor. He's enjoyable to watch. But I thought there was like not quite getting beneath the surface in this.
Oh, that's a shame. It's very interesting talking to filmmakers. They often talk a very, very good game in interviews and they say things that make you think, my God, I have to see this film. That sounds amazing. And you see it and sometimes it's not quite what they say. So it sounds like it may be a case of that. I haven't seen it yet, as you've probably picked up from the fact I'm questioning you all about it. But I kind of had in mind it was going to be like a Skyfall, you know, what it did for Bond, that you'd kind of go back into the past and root around a little bit and kind of would learn secrets. But it sounds like that's not the case.
Yeah, he still remains this very kind of enigmatic figure. Yeah, you still don't really get to know his secrets as such. It's this strange kind of uneven tone, or at least I felt that way, because the action's kind of more brutal than it's been, I think, in the other movies, and there's more going on in that regard. And then it's contrasted with these very quiet scenes that almost, I don't want to say boring, but, you know, it's kind of lurching between the two and it doesn't really feel very cohesive.
I kind of feel that about the first two movies that I watched again this week, ready for this podcast. And they really kind of, I like them. Don't get me wrong. I really enjoy them. And I think Denzel is wonderful. I can watch him all day long in anything. He's one of those actors, whatever he's in, he's always like just superb. But it does feel like they want to have their cake and eat it. You know, he's this very sort of gentle, caring, tranquil man now who knows all about life and how you should treat others and kindness and all of that. And both films have a really sort of gentle tone to them. And then when the violence comes, it really comes. And, you know, he really, really goes for it. And it's like, well, hang on, does this quite fit that, like, you know, he's showing you all about the joy of manners and how people deserve to be treated with respect. And then 2 minutes later, he's putting an axe through someone's head, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
One of the big selling points with this film, I think, is that it reteams Denzel with Dakota Fanning, which I know there's a lot of Tony Scott fans out there, and I'm one of them. And Man on Fire, I mean, it's one of Tony Scott's sort of better later films. And you get Denzel in that playing the bodyguard to a young Dakota Fanning when she was a child. I mean, how do their characters come together in this, and what's their chemistry like? I mean, can you kind of tell that they're old friends?
Dakota Fanning in the movie plays a CIA agent, and Robert McCall gives her this anonymous tip-off about the this operation that the mafia is running. And then their paths, she kind of works out who gave the tip-off, and their paths do cross, which is not the greatest moment in the movie. So they're both sitting outside this cafe. It's all quite inconsequential to the plot. I don't think this counts as a spoiler, but they're sitting outside and she is sort of watching him. And she's trying to take a subtle photo of him, I guess, to send her boss or whoever. And she's left the camera sound on her phone. So he hears her taking the photo and sort of turns around, and that's how they meet. And I just feel like if you're in the CIA, you put your phone on silent, don't you? Is that...
You would. And especially when you're dealing with Robert McCall, he's a bit like Benedict Cumberbatch's Sherlock Holmes, isn't he? In the way that he sort of can hear and see everything and put everything together and, you know, almost superhero type, even though he's meant to be a mere mortal. He's like got the hearing of a bat, for example. But yes, it sounds to me like you're not fully on board of this film. Is that fair to say? Bit lukewarm?
Yeah, I wasn't fully sold, unfortunately.
So just moving forward, before we get onto the next films, I mean, this is meant to be the end of the Equalizer franchise, or the trilogy. Antoine Fuqua's directed all three, Denzel starring. But Antoine did come out last week and say he would be up for doing a prequel with Denzel using AI, or maybe he would. He didn't say he would. He said that he'd consider it, and he's kind of looking at AI technology and it's getting better and better. How do you feel about that? Are you someone who enjoys seeing actors de-aged, and would you want to see a young Denzel?
I'm not the biggest fan of AI de-aging, I have to say. I mean, it's still ambiguous kind of at the end of the film. It's not, you know, a definitive end, but I think it is a nice thematic end to the trilogy. And I think it would be pushing it maybe. And it kind of then, the whole point of this character is that he's enigmatic and elusive. I think it would sort of shatter the illusion to then say, well, this is what happened and how he got to where he is.
It's always a problem, isn't it? Same in horror films when they make a prequel and you suddenly see Leatherface being bullied at school as a kid. Kind of, you don't need it. You don't want to know what's behind that mask. I mean, that's what makes the character. So one last thought for you before we move on. Another way they could go forward with this, which I have seen suggested this week, is maybe cast John David Washington, Denzel's son, for a prequel. And then you don't have the whole de-aging thing, because we've kind of seen in movies like The Irishman and Indiana Jones and The Dial of Destiny, it's not quite there yet. It almost is, but just around the eyes, there's something uncanny valley. I mean, how would you feel about that? If John David was up for it, do you think that would work? Cast him as a young Robert McCall?
I mean, you still got the same issue about backstory, which I don't think is really needed, but it could work, I guess.
I think the thing is, I mean, it's obviously quite a big franchise for Sony, and these studios, they never want it to end, do they? You know, they always find a way. So. So we will see. But anyway, that is The Equalizer 3, which is out now in cinemas. And now we will move on. We will go from crime and brutal punishment to a complicated love triangle full of emotional pain with this.
If my party and my husband doesn't want to dance with me,
I'll dance with you.
Maybe we have to take more risk.
So now you're falling in love with someone else, you're taking that risk.
Think what's happening between us.
You cannot change someone like him. What they think, what they want to do.
I think I'm falling in love with you.
Say that to love the image.
I say it when I feel it.
You say it when it works for you.
So, Emily, that was the trailer for Passages, the new film by Ira Sachs. I mean, set this one up for us. What can we expect?
Well, you can expect a lot of sex.
Of course.
That was kind of the main talking point from the festival run. So that was what I was expecting going in. And yeah, it's not false advertising. So we've got two men who are married, and one of those men then begins an affair with a woman, and then their lives begin to unravel. So it's basically someone ruining their own life, which I quite enjoy as a subject of a film. I do quite enjoy watching people ruin their own lives on screen. So yeah, I enjoyed this one.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very human thing to do, isn't it? Everyone kind of makes mistakes and unravels a little bit. So tell me about this couple. I mean, I've seen this one, so I can sort of jump in and say that Martin is an artist and he's played by Ben Whishaw, who obviously we all know from Q in the Bond films. And Thomas is played by Franz Rogalski, who's in Victoria, that amazing kind of one-shot real-time movie that came out a few years ago. And he's also in Terrence Malick's A Hidden Life. So they're the kind of married couple in this film. And it's Thomas, isn't it, who goes off and has the affair. I mean, how does it come about?
So there are a he's a director and they're at a wrap party for his latest movie, and Ben Whishaw's character goes home early because he needs to get up early the next morning, and I think Thomas is kind of a bit frustrated by that. He wants to stay out, he wants to have some fun, and then he crosses paths with Agathe, who is the woman, and yeah, kind of sparks fly and it descends from there.
Been a lot of talk about this film on the festival circuit and on social media, where it kind of has focus on the sex. And some people on social media have sort of said, oh, there's sex scenes that don't further the plot and there's no need for it. And they've got all very sort of priggish about it. Other people have said, no, it's the sex that absolutely makes the film. I think it was The Guardian that said the sex is the plot, which I kind of agree with. So tell us about the sex. I mean, it's not your usual kind of Hollywood filtered, soft focus, very carefully choreographed sex, is it?
Yeah, no, I found that quite refreshing, really. And I guess the way that it kind of treats both couples having sex in the same way, when you've got two men having sex and you've got a man and a woman having sex, and it's not really relevant, the genders of the people involved. And I mean, I do kind of disagree with the argument that, you know, oh, sex scenes, you know, if they don't further the plot, like, I don't think things need to further the plot to be a good addition to the film at all. But I would agree that, yeah, they are integral to this film, because I don't know, in a way it's almost like another language in the film. Like, you've got French being spoken, English being spoken, and then the sex is then almost the third language between the characters. I think the sex and also the intimacy is kind of key to understanding the relationships that you've got there.
Yeah, I absolutely fully agree with you. So Iris Sachs, I mean, he's a director. He's made he made Little Men a few years ago, which was kind of about a couple of 13-year-olds, their kind of friendship, and it brought in themes of class and gentrification. He did Love is Strange with John Lithgow and Alfred Molina, who played a sort of a, not middle-aged, probably a bit older than that, a sort of older married couple who they're split apart and have to live with separate families for a while. And it's kind of all of the turmoil that comes with that. I mean, what he's known for are very kind of intimate, unfussy, very humane dramas. I mean, does this fall under that category? Is it another one of those?
Yeah, I'd say so, for sure. Yeah, there's no kind of flinching away from like the worst parts of people and the worst parts of relationships either. I'll expose myself and say I haven't seen any of his other films, so I don't know how exactly it fits thematically in with those, but I'd say it definitely comes under that umbrella.
There's a lot of pain and sadness in this film as well, isn't it? But like you said, they kind of, or Thomas certainly kind of brings about his own demise, or the demise of the marriage, and everything begins to collapse because he starts this affair. But I think it's very good at sort of getting to the heart of human behaviour and relationships and dynamics, and basically screwing things up and the fallout of all that. I mean, is that kind of how you felt? Did it hit you in the feels?
Yeah, definitely. I think more Martin and Agathe's from their point of view, because for Thomas, it's sort of a bit like, well, actions have consequences. You kind of got it coming. But I'd say the last scene in particular, I really liked. And I guess, yeah, that kind of prompts a bit of pathos for him, for Thomas, despite what he's been up to for the last 90 minutes. I thought that was really effective. Definitely a bit of an emotional roller coaster.
And just before we move on, I want to mention the dinner table scene, because I love a good, awkward dinner table scene. I always have done. And there's an absolute belter in here where Thomas kind of goes around to Agathe's and meets her parents, and they're all sat at the dinner table. And it's kind of first time he's talked to them. And it's just fantastic, isn't it? Just see awkwardness and then it all blows up and he kind of storms out. I mean, did you enjoy that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I knew it was going to be a good scene when he walks in and meets them for the first time and he's wearing that crop top. Huge behaviour to meet your in-laws for the first time dressed like that. So yeah, no, that was a great scene.
Great. Well, that is Passages, which is in cinemas on Friday. Okay, now we're going to go from shaking up relationships to shaking up an entire country with this.
He came from the ghetto. He had no father. He had no ma. He was different.
I didn't have so many dreams. But when I met her, she made me realize that I can actually impact lives.
Presidential candidate Bobby Wine.
This is a military regime that you cannot vote out.
Ugandans have always wanted equality, freedom, and dignity.
Somebody had to speak for us. People thought I had the loudest voice around.
We are having an election 8 days from now.
Our home is surrounded by soldiers. Do you know you are trespassing?
We are in very dangerous times. Museveni is targeting everybody around me.
They shot down one of our people.
Obi, are you ready for them?
What else is there other than to be ready?
Pep talk.
So, Emily, the last film we're going to discuss this week is Bobby Wine, The People's President. Tell us about this. It's a documentary, isn't it? And for people who don't know who Bobby Wine is and don't know their Ugandan politics, I mean, fill us in on this one.
So Bobby Wine he was a very successful musician and pop star in Uganda, and I think popular in the rest of the continent as well. And he ran to be MP in a by-election about 10 years ago. And then that kind of propelled a political career. And he ended up running for president in their last election. And their current president has been in for about 30 years, I think. And the main thing that Bobby Wine was kind of campaigning against is they had an age limit on how old you could be to run for president. And the current president, Museveni, he hit that age limit and then, surprise, surprise, decided to repeal that so he could run again. And Bobby Wine kind of led the campaign against that, which was not successful. But yeah, and then that kind of snowballed into a presidential campaign and a people-driven campaign as well.
Like you say, the current president, he'd been there since 1986 and he'd ran like 4 or 5 terms, which was the limit. And he was about to sort of hit the age limit of 75. Which has always been the case in Ugandan politics. At 75, you have to step aside, and then he decides to raise the age limit. I mean, he's obviously a kind of autocrat, a dictator, call it what you will. Bobby Wine is just, it's an incredible, incredible feat of bravery in a way, because as this documentary unfolds, it's unbelievable the stuff that happens, isn't it? That happens to him and his campaigners. I mean, we see his driver shot, but they actually think it's Bobby Wine and they shoot the driver. Bobby Wine at one point is held in a military barracks and tortured. His supporters are arrested. Bobby is charged with treason. As the 2021 election is coming up and he's running his campaign, his office is raided. 140 of his campaigners are abducted, put on trial. Bobby's put under house arrest. And on the eve of the election, the 2021 election, the whole internet and mobile data and everything of Uganda goes down or is taken away so that no one can discuss anything and no one can sort of send any messages outside the country. And then, of course, the sitting president wins. It's just incredible. I mean, when you were watching it, my feeling was I just don't know how, I'm full of admiration, but how anyone can be that courageous to kind of face death every day. You know, he kind of thinks, you know, at some point I've been tortured, I've been everything, I'm probably going to be killed, but this is more important than me.
Yeah, no, the bravery is unbelievable, really. Yeah, the kind of state that he was in after he's held in that military facility, when they release him, you know, he's on crutches, you know, he can barely walk, and that's after several days as well. So yeah, it's quite horrific, really, the treatment and, you know, the deaths of the protesters in the streets. And I think his political team. They were incarcerated for 5 months in the run-up to the election. Yeah, it's just insane, really.
I mean, that bravery also extends to the filmmakers, doesn't it? Because they're kind of right there. They've got amazing access to Bobby Wine over 5 years. They're kind of there. You see his marriage, which is amazing, this rock steady marriage, and his wife's kind of supporting him and his children. So it's an intimate portrait as well as a political one. But the film crew are right there on the streets when people are being arrested, when people are being kind of shot at, when Bobby Wine's in huge trouble. It really reminded me of, like, it's proper kind of war footage in a way, isn't it? War reportage. So, I mean, did you feel that watching it? Did you kind of feel, I was almost curled up in a ball at some points thinking, like, you know, the filmmakers are going to be shot here or killed?
Yeah, no, as you say, they've got this incredible access to him, and because it covers several years, you know, it starts from the very first beginnings of his political career back in like 2014, and they're following him through all those years and through COVID as well. When that kicks off, the government used that as a big crackdown on protests and gatherings and things. And obviously, you know, you've got people getting sick and stuff. So yeah, definitely.
Absolutely mad. I mean, did you like it? It sounds like you did. I mean, I was really taken with it. I thought it was a really dynamic, brave, intimate portrait of someone. And it really kind of lifted the lid off something I didn't know a lot about, to be honest.
I mean, yeah, for my ignorance, yeah, I'd never heard of Bobby Wine before. I wasn't, you know, I'm not familiar with Ugandan politics. So yeah, I found it really interesting. I think for me, I guess, only criticism maybe, I kind of wanted to hear a bit more from his supporters, because it was a very, you know, people power, public driven campaign. Like, that's where he gets his power from. I know it's because it's the alternative to their current system, but there were a few vox pops with people out in the streets, but I would have been interested to hear just a little bit more from ordinary people, I think.
He grew up in the slums, didn't he? And he became known as the ghetto president because he was very much the voice of the people. And like you said, I think just him standing up against this kind of regime, to having the bravery to do that and be all about kind of freedom. I love that bit when he's interviewed. I think it was on telly, and they sort of said, if you get in, if you become president, you know, what's to say you won't do this? Because this president, Museveni, I mean, when he started in 1986, he was saying all the stuff that Bobby Wine was saying. And then power corrupts, and here we are all these years later, and he refuses to let go. And they ask Bobby about it, and he's just so sort of open about it, just saying, yes, that may happen. You know, power does corrupt. That's a terrible thing, but we've got to make sure it doesn't happen. We've got to change the system. We've got to change the rules and regulations so that even if I do sort of go that way and get corrupted, I can't do that. You know, it has to change. Yeah. So I loved all of that. So anyway, it's two big thumbs up for me. I thought it was great, and it sounds like you were a fan as well. Okay, so before we go, just a couple of things to wrap up. Number one is a little bit of promotion for the issue of Total Film, which is on sale at the moment. It's got the Marvels on the cover, the new MCU movie. Absolutely great cover feature, really dives in depth into that one. A big career interview with Shane Meadows, because Dead Man's Shoes turns 20, believe it or not, this year or next year, early next year. I mean, it's just mad. It feels like yesterday I first saw that at a press screening. We've got Emma Stone, who's in Poor Things. We got a big feature on Exorcist Believer, which 50 years after William Friedkin's original masterpiece is a kind of legacy sequel, which brings back Ellen Bernstein as Chris McNeil. So that's a big one. So yeah, so get down your local newsagents, or it's available digital as well, but the new issue of Total Film. Now, before we go, Emily, we've got a reader's question here, which we are good old readers and listeners always come in with these questions. Now, this one, I think, is probably inspired by the fact that the new David Fincher film, The Killer, is about to play in Venice. So the question is, what is your favourite David Fincher movie?
For me, knee-jerk answer is Gone Girl. Ben Affleck comic performance. Love it.
Yeah. Have you read the book?
I love Sharp Objects as well.
Yeah, it's a very smart adaptation of that book, Gone Girl, I think. For me, it would be a toss-up between Zodiac, which I think is maybe his masterpiece in terms of it goes so deep into those characters and how obsession can completely hollow out people. I just think it's a technically brilliant crime film. And Fight Club, which I watched again recently, and I just think it's more prescient now and more kind of on the button now than even when it came out, because you've had the whole rise of the right throughout Europe, you know, you've had incel culture, all of that, and it just really feels like it kind of saw all of that coming, and it's actually more disturbing to watch it now than it was back in 1999. So I can't separate those two. That's my two choices. So, Emily, just before we go, I'm going to put you on the spot. What is your film of the week?
For me, it's Passages, I think.
With me, I mean, bearing in mind I haven't seen Equalizer 3 yet, I will be going this weekend, but I'm going to go Bobby Wine, the People's President, which is out in cinemas on Friday. And it really got to me. I thought it was fantastic. So before we go, everyone, just a quick reminder that if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing. Just press the button and you're all set to go. And Emily, I'd like to thank you for joining me. Thank you so much for all of your insight and thoughts. And we'll be back next week, everyone, with Inside Total Film. Until then, enjoy your movies. Goodbye.
Bye.
Come on. Let's talk about sex, baby.